Nuclear reactors worldwide. Given the propaganda that permeates nuclear claims and the manipulative definitions of terms and standards they use to favorably tote up the stats on their planet-polluting product, it's hard to get a reliable picture of where the industry actually stands. But then you talk to a genuine expert, one who has worked since the 1990s to compile reliable data on nuclear industry activities into an internationally respected report. And among the wealth of information he shares, when you ask him about new nuclear builds, he tells you,
all of the 25 construction sites in the world are either in China or implemented by the Russian nuclear industry. And since China does not have any construction project right now abroad, it's very clear that Russia has become the key vendor of nuclear technology in the world.
Anytime any country mentions the word nuclear, you know, let's say it's Somalia or it is Ghana, and somebody there says, maybe we should be developing nuclear power, a Russian diplomat will be there from Rosatom the next day with a piece of paper that is some kind of a memorandum of understanding that says, we will do a study for you to look at how nuclear power can contribute to meeting your energy needs. Then a couple of years later, there'll be another study that talks a little bit more about this. And there's a series of these things and eventually might culminate in an order for a construction.
Well, when Michael Schneider, coordinator and publisher of the annual World Nuclear Industry Status Report, points out the strategies underlying the increase in new nuclear power reactor builds around the world, and so much more, you get a clear-eyed, unflinching look at the exact reach and extent of that terrible, dangerous seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, the first of a two-part interview on the World Nuclear Industry Status Report, a comprehensive overview of nuclear power plant data, including information on operation, production, construction, and decommissioning. It has been described as a barrier against utopian fantasies and wishful thinking, a tool to connect with reality. We will talk with three of the people instrumental in the creation of the 2022 World Nuclear Industry Status Report: Michael Schneider, M.V. Ramana, and Michael Tyler. We will also have nuclear news from around the world: Linda Pence Gunter with the Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story, Numbnuts of the Week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, and more honest nuclear information than was leaked from the Pentagon this week. Or maybe not. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, April 11, 2023, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Starting in the U.S., where this week Holtec, the company charged with decommissioning both the Indian Point nuclear reactor in New York and Pilgrim up in Boston, upped the amps on its behaviors, demonstrating that they will not obey rules, regulations, or the law. This week, Holtec accelerated their timeline for discharging radioactive wastewater into the Hudson River, up to 45,000 gallons from the Unit 2 fuel pool, and that it will now occur as early as Thursday, May 4th, only 3 weeks from now, and that's 3 months earlier than they previously scheduled. 10 municipal and county resolutions in opposition to the releases in the weeks following their initial announcement have had no impact. Now, New York State Senator Harkin and Assemblymember Levenberg have introduced legislation to prohibit the discharge of any radiological agent into the waters of the state. NGO watchdog Clearwater is calling for urgent action to pass the Harkin-Levenberg bill and for Governor Hochul to sign it into law before May 4th to stop Holtec's releases of the radioactive wastewater. And they're calling for you, if you live in New York State, to contact your state senator and assembly member and ask them to support Senate Bill 5181 or Assembly Bill 5338. In Massachusetts, an independent study of potential risks related to Holtec's plan to release 1 million gallons of radioactive wastewater from the former Pilgrim nuclear facility into Cape Cod Bay has been given lip service by Holtec CEO Krishna Singh, who said, "I think your suggestion to have experts review and study is a great suggestion. We will support it wholeheartedly," but refused to allow Pilgrim's decommissioning trust fund to be used for this purpose. The decommissioning trust fund initially contained over $1 billion that was contributed over many years by ratepayers. And Holtec stands to keep what remains in the fund at the end of the decommissioning process, estimated to be $252 million. Their stated intentions are to dump the radioactive water into Cape Cod Bay by late summer, early fall. Here's Linda Pence Gunter with this week's Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story.
Those of us who follow the nuclear power issue every day, and many of you listening to this program, already know that the proposal to expand the use of nuclear power makes absolutely no sense on any level. We are in a climate crisis now. We must deliver the solutions at hand, and they must be fast and affordable. New reactors aren't here, aren't economical, and don't solve the safety and waste problems. And yet, here comes the US Department of Energy promoting not only small modular reactors, but now traditional large ones as well. Maybe one could argue that the DOE has seen the light on SMRs, that small reactors, because of their poor economies of scale, would end up being even more expensive than large ones. But the DOE hasn't so much seen the light as been blinded by it. In a new report, the department brags that the US could and should build around 200 to 300 new full-scale reactors by 2050. Fortunately, there is someone around to do the math, and that would be investigative reporter Stephanie Cook, author of the 2009 book In Mortal Hands, A Cautionary History of the Nuclear Age, whose title and contents are more apt today than ever. Writing in Energy Intelligence, which is thankfully not behind a paywall, Cook tots up the costs for DOE's grand plan. The number she comes up with is between $3.5 trillion and $5.25 trillion. Yes, trillion with a T, which, as Cook points out, is more than double the $1.5 trillion the US plans to spend over 30 years overhauling its nuclear arsenal, and in the neighborhood of the government's $6.9 trillion budget proposal for the entire nation in 2024. She rightly calls all this beyond absurd and irresponsible. We've heard this kind of fantasy rhetoric before, of course. During the supposed new nuclear boom years in the early 2000s, as many as 34 new reactors were expected to be licensed and built. Four eventually got started, with two of them, in South Carolina, shuttering operations before completion. The remaining two, in Georgia, have costs ballooning to over $34 billion. Of course, as Cook also writes, resources devoted to rescuing a dying industry are resources that wouldn't be available for viable, less costly strategies to achieve net zero emissions in the power sector. This is precisely the argument made in numerous papers that are not commissioned by an agency still wedded to nuclear dinosaurs of the 20th century and what Cook calls a nuclear-centric culture. Nuclear squeezes out renewables. As Benjamin Sovacool, Andy Sterling, and colleagues at Sussex University have written, countries planning large-scale new nuclear investments are risking suppression of greater climate benefits from alternative renewable energy investments, a bit like investing in caviar to fight world hunger. The DOE could be poised to spend $3 trillion of our tax dollars on that nuclear caviar. We and our elected representatives need to tell them we would much rather eat cheaper, safer, and far more digestible peanut butter and jelly sandwiches instead. I'm Linda Pence-Gunter with Beyond Nuclear, reporting for Nuclear Hot Seat. And that's this week's hot story.
From Ukraine comes word that on October 19, the Ukrainian military attempted to regain control of the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant from Russia, but were unable to achieve it because, as they stated, defense was dense, everything was mined, the Ukrainians were fired at from tanks and artillery, and the main force was unable to land. As of last Thursday, April 6, the Russian invaders abducted four employees of the Physical Protection Service of the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant and took them away. Their whereabouts remain unknown. In Japan, 338 cases of childhood thyroid cancer have been confirmed in the Fukushima Health Management Survey. But note that children eligible to be followed in this study have to be living in Fukushima, not have moved away, or gone to doctors outside of those covered by the study. So the numbers may be much higher. And in a separate study, some 37% of the survivors of Japan's Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant disaster suffer from post-traumatic stress due to, quote, anxieties about compensation and indemnification, unemployment, and nuisances just by being an evacuee. Talk about understatement and misdirection. And climate, energy, and environmental ministers from the G7 are considering stressing the importance of nuclear power for energy security and welcome Japan's plan to release 1.3 million tons of radioactive water into the Pacific Ocean. And as if that's not numbnuts enough.
Nuclear hot seat. Nuclear hot seat. Nuclear hot seat. Numbnuts of the week.
This one has me furious. NuScale, the company pushing small modular nuclear reactors, none produced, and only one design only recently approved for development, has launched a corporate branding TV ad touting how beautiful the world will be when their, quote, carbon-free energy power plants are built. But what they're talking about is small modular nuclear reactors. Only in the entire ad, they neglect to mention the N-word, nuclear, even once. They say SMR power plants instead of what they are, small modular nuclear reactors, none of which have yet been built, let alone implemented, if they ever will be. The 60-second ad, which has been spotted on MSNBC and presumably other cable news programs, features a blonde-haired Caucasian little girl who is so conscious she even has a clear glass world globe lit up as the lamp on her bedside table as she gets up to stare wide-eyed at the transformational wonders being shown her by this magical technology. Others whose lives in these ads have been magically improved by this nuclear nonsense include a clearly impoverished third world boy, an Asian woman hiker, and even a Prince Harry lookalike casually seated on a bench, a subliminal meant to imply that the former HRH approves of NuScale as the energy savior of the planet. The nonstop lies take the form of language, image, and exclusion of salient points. Remember, SMR power plants equals small modular nuclear reactors. The only truth in this piece, which is inadvertent, is when the voiceover states, it will connect our lives like never before. Alas, they aren't referring to the legacy of radioactive waste produced by SMNRs at a rate 20 times higher than what current nuclear reactors produce, and that we, the people of the planet, will have to deal with this deadly legacy for the next 250,000 years. It's not the selling point they had intended. This is heinous, cold-blooded, nuclear corporate manipulation of the public by smug, lying, nuclear expletives deleted. And that's why, NuScale, you are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Numbnuts of the Week.
We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment. But first, the nuclear industry, as you will hear, never lets up with their propaganda. Using talking points, op-eds, talk show bookers, paid video ads, and other tactics to brainwash our politicians, reporters, and the public into giving them whatever they want, which is money, 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 and more money. And let's face it, they already have all the money in the world to fund their PR agencies and agenda. Remember, public relations is defined as the manufacture of consent, and that's what they're trying to do to us. Train us into consenting to nuclear. And if you don't agree with their campaign to promote what ultimately undermines people and the planet, that is why you need Nuclear Hot Seat. For 12 years now, Nuclear Hot Seat has been one of the only places on the planet where you can get a one-hour hit of honest nuclear information every week. We provide interviews with genuine experts, a roundup of international news, numbnuts, the hot story, humor where we can. Where else can you find all this in a weekly counterbalance to nuclear industry lies? But up against that industry's unlimited financial resources, this show operates on a bake sale budget. And that budget is entirely dependent upon you, the listeners, to keep us going. That's why every week I ask and keep my fingers crossed that some of you will join us in showing your appreciation for Nuclear Hot Seat with a donation. Right now's as good a time as any. Go to nuclearhotseat.com. Click on the red donate button and help us with a donation of any amount, be it one time only or recurring on a monthly basis. Give what you can now and know that however much you can help, I'm deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now here's this week's featured interview. Today, part one of an extended Nuclear Hot Seat on the annual World Nuclear Industry Status Report. It is a comprehensive overview of nuclear power data, including information on operation, production, construction, and decommissioning. Every year, it provides a clear, data-based look at what is actually happening within the nuclear industry to counteract the hype and inaccuracies put out by the industry itself. As Avio Verbruggen writes in the foreword of the 2022 edition, every yearly report is a barrier against utopian fantasies and wishful thinking, a tool to connect with reality. We are honored to have with us on Nuclear Hot Seat three of the people instrumental in the creation of the 2022 World Nuclear Industry Status Report. Michael Schneider works as an independent international analyst and consultant on energy and nuclear policy and is based in Paris. He is the initiator and convening lead author of the World Nuclear Industry Status Report. Hello, Michael.
Hello there.
M.V. Ramana is professor and Simons Chair in Disarmament, Global and Human Security at the School of Public Policy and Global Affairs at the University of British Columbia. Hello, Ramana.
Hi, Libby.
And Michael Zeiler is an independent consultant on nuclear energy. He has more than 40 years of experience in the field, most notably regarding the safety of nuclear power plants and other nuclear facilities, and the storage and final disposal of nuclear and other radioactive waste. Thank you for joining us, Michael.
Thank you.
I am joined as co-interviewer by Linda Pence Gunter of Beyond Nuclear, who provides this show's regular feature, the Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story. Let's start with Michael Schneider. Explain to us, what is the World Nuclear Industry Status Report? When did it start and why?
The World Nuclear Industry Status Report now has quite a long history. We had a sort of a precursor edition in 1992. And the basic idea then was already to do an annual analysis. Obviously, we never got the funding together to keep on going. So there was a big gap until 2004, and then another gap until 2007. And from then on, it was published in different formats, parts in the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, starting in 2008. In 2009, it was released by the German government, entirely funded by the Ministry of the Environment. And then from 2012 onwards, it was always the same job, trying to look for funding. I might as well publish it myself. basically cut out an intermediate and more complexity, and also it made it more independent. So what I basically do is I do fundraising for the project. I hire the various people that work on the project. Why did we decide to do this? I call the status report a carpet for debate. I think we have today a real huge problem, and that has increased over the past, let's say, 5 years. There is a gap, a widening and deepening gap between the perception of the nuclear sector and the industrial reality. And the status report is really meant to bridge that gap, to say, okay, before debating, we need to agree on a certain number of facts and figures. And that's what the status report is all about. It doesn't carry any recommendations. It doesn't carry any requests or demands or anything like that. The idea is really to come up with something that people can agree on. These are the numbers. And then we can discuss. You can say, is this good or bad? And then you can get into the debate. But before doing that, you have to agree on some kind of basis. And that's what the report is all about.
Where do you source your data?
I think it's something like 1,600 references, 1,600 footnotes. So it's one of the values added to the work. Is it's not only analysis. It also provides people with the original data, the sources, as much as we can, because it's always additional work. We provide people with online links so they can keep on digging into where the information comes from. What are the main sources? For reactor data, we take the raw data from the International Atomic Energy Agency and we repair it. We take the data and we correct it because there is a huge amount of problems with the data. This is not to say that our data are perfect. There's statistics are complicated and there's always problems. As soon as you go back in history, you realize that there are problems with data series because the definition of a given indicator changes. And the idea of the status report is really a multi-indicator analysis. It's like a puzzle. In order to get the full picture, you need all the pieces. You cannot just look at a number of pieces. And the additional issue with the nuclear sector, it's a long-term issue. You don't understand trends and developments if you compare 2 years between each other. Say between 2021 and 2022. That gives you the last peak. It's a photograph. But what we need to do is to look at the film, at the movie, in order to understand what the trends are and why we are where we are today. And that also, while we do not do prospective scenarios or, you know, we don't do forecasting. We leave the crystal ball analysis to other people. We're trying to, you know, keep it empirically in order to draw our conclusions.
I'd like to add one point to what Michael said, which is that in the news media, we often see just snapshots. They'll say 50 reactors are being built around the world or something of that sort, without telling us anything about how that compares with the historical numbers. And I think that's one of the great values of the World Nuclear Industry Status Report.
Each year has a special focus. How was it chosen, and what is the focus for the 2022 report?
This whole project is a continuous activity. It's not that you just decide at some point you start writing. It's thinking about issues, thinking about authors, et cetera, et cetera. And then we basically have a wish list for topics. But deciding on a topic does not mean that you have an author. You can say, we have had this issue, this problem several times before. It's like we decided on a certain specific focus because we thought within the discussion of the day, it's obvious that there is a specific interest. And in the case of 2022, it was very clear that nuclear power and war was an obvious issue to be chosen. That was an easy one to pick. But then who's going to draft that? You know, who is the appropriate person to the appropriate author to actually put together a draft? We have a very thorough and complicated and deep review process. And Michael, who contributed the draft chapter on nuclear power and war, has experienced that difficult long-term back and forth, you know, between reviewers and commons. It's a process. It's not just writing a chapter.
One of your headlines is that nuclear power's global share just dropped below 10% for the first time in about four decades. Is that the big headline for this year's report? And are there others?
There is a symbolic issue around this 10%, that the first time in 40 years that the share of nuclear power in commercial electricity generation drops below 10% again is particularly symbolic, because at the same time, just wind and solar went beyond 10%. In other words, past the relevance and the share of nuclear power in commercial electricity. As you say, it's a headline, but it's a 400-page report. So there's a lot of, and it's interesting, if you look at media coverage, obviously nuclear power and war was a big one, but every journalist picks out other angles. You have dominating angles, but people choose different angles from their view.
There's no other major headline as such, but I think the other aspect we might want to highlight has been the role of Russia in building nuclear power plants in other parts of the world, and especially in the aftermath of their attack on Ukraine and the war that's going on there. This is, I think, something worth highlighting.
Looking at the history of this, while much is made of new nuclear startups, we see a massive peak of startups in the mid-1980s compared with today. What was happening then that isn't happening now, or what's happening now that wasn't happening then?
In the early phase of nuclear power plant construction, the understanding we have about the costs and the time delays and the risks were just not present. And especially after the two severe accidents at Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania and Chernobyl in Europe, I think policymakers around the world had a much better understanding of the safety risks, of the accident risks associated with them. And the public, and more important, started asking tougher questions. So I think there's a very natural decline in the level of construction that you would see.
If you have a peak of startups in 1984-85, so just the year before Chernobyl happened in 1986, it obviously means that these reactors have been under construction for some time. So it is interesting to note that the historic peak of reactors listed as under construction was in 1979. That number is 234. Which compares with something like 59 at the end of 2022 or at the 1st of January 2023. That is exactly what Ramana meant earlier by saying it's important to look, what does that mean? 59 reactors under construction historically. So if it peaked in terms of number of reactors under construction, every eighth reactor under construction has not been completed. That should be said as well. There is a huge load of concrete and steel in the rain, out in the rain, that has never been finished. It also means that the peak of construction starts was in 1976. The number of construction starts peaked at 44 units. So if we have 10 construction starts in 2022, which is more than we had 5 years earlier, it's still very low compared to what we have seen in the 1970s.
Each year you make a point about defining what operating means, as in operating nuclear reactors. We see numbers from the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, and other sources. Why do you consider those numbers to be misleading?
The biggest single issue with that is the status of nuclear reactors in Japan. After the Fukushima disaster started, because it's not over, started in March 2011, the entire fleet at some point in 2014 was down, so did not generate any electricity. But the International Atomic Energy Agency kept those reactors that did not generate any power for years in the statistics as operating. So what does that mean? I mean, what does operating mean? We consider that the term operating needs a physical definition. So if a reactor does not generate any power for a calendar year, plus 6 months of the current year, so 18 months uninterrupted, no supply of electricity, we take it out of the statistics of operating nuclear reactors and put it into a category that we call long-term outage. That has been for us a very important point, because if you look at the statistics, we had at some point 37 units in 2012 with the statistics of the International Atomic Energy Agency, most of them, which we considered, because they have not generated any power for 18 months in a row, under the definition I gave, we took them out of the statistics and the IAEA kept them in the statistics as operating. Now, in 2022, an interesting development happened, and that's not in the report yet. The IAEA decided, after lengthy discussions, negotiations with the Japanese government and industry representatives, to take out a certain number of reactors in several goals. They took out 16 reactors under their definition of operating and put them into a new category called suspended operation. It's very interesting because it basically shows that the IAEA got closer to our definition. And it's very clear that we have been calling the attitude of the IAEA misleading for a number of years. And it's very clear that our repeated pointing out that misleading character in the numbers helped the IAEA to negotiate Japan to get a different definition of operating reactor.
Delving into the report, let's start with two important countries that skew the numbers quite a bit, China and Russia. First, China. Linda?
I think one of the most striking things in the report, amongst all the many graphs, is the differentiation between China and the rest of the world. You've got two sets of numbers and you separate China out. Can you describe, you know, what role China plays in what can be perceived as those apparent growth numbers, albeit you've already qualified that it's only compared to maybe last year. But we see China, you know, dominating in a way for the last 20 years on your graphs, even to the point where this most recent number, you have pretty much 50-50 of the new build in the world being China. So talk a little bit about the importance of China in these numbers.
You can basically characterize the current status of nuclear new build in a very simple manner. China builds at home and Russia abroad. That's it. It's very striking to see over the past 3 years, over 3 years now, since the construction start of Hinkley Point C in the UK, the second reactor that started building in December 2019, all of the 25 construction starts in the world are either in China or implemented by the Russian nuclear industry. And since China does not have any construction project right now abroad, it's very clear that Russia has become the key vendor of nuclear technology in the world. It's striking. But if you see that you have, and I'm talking 1st of January statistic, you had 22 reactors under construction in China, which is by far the most in the world, but Russian-designed reactors were implemented on 25 reactor sites in the world, so in 8 different countries outside Russia. So no other construction site was started over the past 3 years other than by Russia. And that includes also 4 reactors that Russia builds in China. It's interesting to see that relationship was not damaged, at least not visibly. That relationship between China and Russia was not damaged by the war in Ukraine.
One thing one should remember about China is that China is building everything in a way. their electricity sector, the energy sector is growing very rapidly. And nuclear power, despite all that we hear about China's prowess in that field, constitutes only around 5% of the country's electricity supply. All sources of energy are growing there. So last in 2021, for example, the increase in wind and solar energy were 40 and 25%. Even coal increased by 9%, and nuclear increased by about 11%. So everything is growing, and renewables especially are growing very, very fast. At some point, I think Chinese policymakers will have to make a reckoning with the costs and the time it takes to grow nuclear power in comparison with how fast and how much more affordably they can increase their renewable contributions.
And that was actually going to be a follow-up question, which maybe you can both jump in on, which is really that when you look at China, they're sort of doing that all of the above thing, which is actually criticized, in fact, in many circles as detrimental to addressing climate change. So they are doing lots of renewables. They're doing some nuclear, as you described, even increasing coal. Is that do everything? This is a little bit of a, you know, devil's advocate question, but is that do everything policy working for them, even as we in the wider world say, no, actually that torpedoes your efforts to mitigate the climate crisis?
Maybe to complement Ramana's point, and you immediately see how the development is going faster and faster and on renewables and slower on nuclear. We got the figures for 2022 now that China started up three new nuclear reactors, and that's together 2.2 gigawatts of capacity. That's 2,200 megawatts, to clarify. In renewables, just wind and solar, the capacity added as 125 gigawatts. 125 versus 2.2. And if you look at the output, so this is just the capacity, and per installed gigawatt, of course, nuclear power generates more than wind and solar, of course. You know, we have seen a gigantic increase in wind and solar, respectively 14 and 12%, while the output of nuclear only increased by 2.5%. So it goes faster and faster on the renewable side and slower and slower. And I remind everyone that numbers that are thrown out in terms of objectives or five-year plan are not necessarily the ones that are real. China missed its own five-year plan target for nuclear power in 2020. And of course, we know that they will miss their 2025 target as well, because anything that is not under construction by now will not be generating power in 2025. So we know already that they missed their own target. It's just to say, take it with a pinch of salt when you read in the papers these objectives for gigantic plans of nuclear power development in China.
And we're going to move on to Russia now as well. As Libby mentioned, that's the other sort of big country, and you've already described how much of an exporter they are. Before I turn it over to you, Libby, though, I just want to throw in one question about Russia to bring in another part of the world, and that's Africa, which doesn't feature significantly in the report for obvious reasons, which is that the only country with nuclear power plants in Africa at the moment is South Africa. But in talking about Russia and where it's actually building, you also do mention its intentions, and a lot of those countries that are listed in terms of where it seems to want to get a foothold are in fact in Africa. So I was wondering whether you foresee in future reports Africa, I mean, hopefully not, but will we see Africa now become a statistic in the report where Russia succeeds, let's say, in getting new construction underway in those countries? Or is it, as you said, you know, largely just a sort of symbolic public relations exercise to create diplomatic ties for other reasons?
In general, in the status report, we don't go into reasons and things like that. This is very much focused on data. So it's hard for us to say on the basis of the report why Russia might be doing something of the sort, why China might be doing something of the sort. But one has other sources of information, and they clearly suggest that Russia is in the process of trying to push its influence a whole range of countries and using energy as one way to do that. Nuclear power is one arena where Russia has some unique advantages in terms of its ability to finance nuclear construction in other countries and in its ability to, in principle, take back some of the spent fuel generated in Russian nuclear plants. These are not things, for example, the United States can offer easily. And so there are advantages that Russia uses. And also, having observed how Russia operates, they have clearly a set modus operandi, how they do it. To put it sort of simply, anytime any country mentions the word nuclear, you know, let's say it's, Somalia or it is Ghana, and somebody there says, maybe we should be developing nuclear power, a Russian diplomat will be there from Rosatom the next day with a piece of paper that is some kind of a memorandum of understanding that says, we will do a study for you to look at how nuclear power can contribute to meeting your energy needs. Then a couple of years later, there'll be another study that talks a little bit more about this. And there's a series of these things and eventually might culminate in an order for a construction. That seems to be what's happening behind the scenes. None of us are there to see how these things happen, nor do we actually see any of these contracts. So we don't really know what these things mean, say, except for what is reported in the media.
Looking further into Russia and the way it has worked its way into being such a major exporter of nuclear technology, it sometimes appears that this is their way of conducting the Cold War on the ground, using nuclear as the delivery system for aligning countries with it. And the question I have is, once a country falls in bed, as it were, with Russia for nuclear, and Russia is supplying the materials, the education, possibly taking back some of the waste, this full functioning service that they're providing, what options does that country have in the future to pull away from Russia should their politics not be in alignment, or should Russia make a political or diplomatic demand upon them that they're not comfortable following through on? How might nuclear be used as a bludgeon on them to make them fall into alignment? Can they get away from it?
The problem of this full service is, number one, this country will not look for a waste management system because Russia will take it back. So it depends from waste management from that country. All other vendors, which are not on the marketplace, but of course, they never had offered taking back nuclear waste. Secondly, the nuclear fuel, which is most important for continuous operation. You need several years in advance to order nuclear fuel because you have to look for the uranium, you have to look for the enrichment work, you have to look for the fuel fabrication. And that means if one country decides to change from the supply of by Russia, it has several years where it has to continue for looking for Russian fuel, and at the same time looking for competing other countries. That's actually the problem which has Ukraine, because they do not want to light Russian fuel, but their nuclear power plants need Russian fuel. Third, competence for repair, for reconstruction, for major maintenance. As long as you have only the possibility to get Russian support, you have to look for other countries which can supply such support that runs maybe a little bit faster than the supply of fuel. But in any case, you cannot change within months. You need several years. And that means in total that supply of the fuel, supply of the waste management, supply of maintenance. You are very dependent from Russian, would have change period of several years to come to other potential suppliers.
The current situation is the demonstration of what you can call in a geopolitical lock-in effect that is linked to what Michael Zeiler described, that you depend on a provider of not only fuel and take back of waste, but also all the time maintenance and other services. We have seen the most problematic dependence on one hand, Ukraine, that has tried to get rid of Russian fuel ever since 2014. And it's a good example because it shows that how long it took to get about half of the reactors. I don't know whether Michael Zeiler has another number, but roughly half of the Ukrainian reactors now operate or could operate on Westinghouse fuel that has developed the technology to fabricate, manufacture those fuel elements. But in the European Union, you have 5 countries that use Russian fuel. There's 19 reactors, and 15 reactors of those are VVER 440 reactors. Why is that important? Because Russia is the only manufacturer of fuel for that specific type of reactor. Not even Westinghouse is offering that fuel. Westinghouse is offering fuel for VVER 1000 reactors, and only 4 of them, 2 in Bulgaria and 2 in the Czech Republic, are VVER 1000s. So these 15 other reactors are condemned to be supplied by Russia. And we had a complete ban of flights out of Russia into the European Union airspace, except for humanitarian aid flights and for nuclear fuel. I think that's a pretty clear demonstration how strong the dependence is.
Small modular nuclear reactors are also a concern as they've come to the fore in the discussions. Linda?
Certainly. So we've seen obviously a huge amount of hype around small modular reactors as sort of the breakthrough for the new nuclear power plants. But we do have some real-time experiences of small modular reactors underway in Argentina, China, Russia, where they either started or even completed them. So what has that experience been like so far in terms of some of the issues we've seen with older reactors, like time and cost, for example?
Many countries have been talking about small modular nuclear reactors. These seem to be exhibiting the same kinds of problems we've seen with large reactors as well. Cost and time overruns, delays in even start of construction, and these are exhibited in many different countries. So to take an example of the country that we were talking about a little while ago, China, clearly the country with the most number of nuclear plants under construction, China built these 2 high-temperature gas-cooled reactor units at Shandong, and the construction was supposed to take 15 months. In actual fact, it took more than twice that, and the extent that we've been able to make out, the 2 units are still not operating properly. There is a lot of uncertainty about what's happening there, and the data that we have seen suggests that they are not contributing any electricity to the grid. So even though they technically started working in December 2021, I don't know whether we should still consider them to be operational. And the costs there are said to be around 40% more per unit of electricity generated there as compared to the light water reactors that China is building. Earlier on, there were plans to build many more of those. Those plans all seem to have vanished. That's in China. Similar stories can be talked about in Argentina, in Russia, where they built a KLT-40S on a barge called the Academic Lomonosov. That reactor was supposed to have started operating in 3 years, but actually construction took 13 years. And there was a huge cost overrun there as well. And after it started operating, the capacity factors we have seen are quite small. So I can sort of go on in this vein, but this is the general picture that we are getting about small modular reactors.
And in the US, in the report, you cite numbers from Taxpayers for Common Sense from December 2021 showing the US Department of Energy having spent more than $1.2 billion US on small modular reactors already, and that the department could spend potentially another $5.5 billion over the next decade. Are there any updates to these numbers? And what have we seen for that money so far?
I have not seen any major updates. I mean, as you know quite Well, the bulk of DOE funding today in the US has been to try and keep the reactors that are operating right now continue to operate. You know, they're throwing money at Diablo Canyon, for example, you know, Michigan Palisades plant, things of that sort. But the issue for the DOE is that none of the SMR projects are moving fast enough for them to be able to funnel the kinds of money they want to funnel, because most of this is meant for construction. Prior to construction, you know, they have been giving money to the NuScale project, for example, for trying to get the design licensed. So far, NuScale has spent something like $1.1 billion on developing its design, which probably around somewhere between $400 and $500 million probably came from the DOE. And the rest of it has come from NuScale and other, from Flower and other investors. And that SMR design is still quite far from being ready to start construction, because what NuScale's experience actually tells us is something which many of us have been telling from the very early stages, which is that when you go to smaller reactors, you lose out on what are called economies of scale. To build a plant that generates 1,000 megawatts of electricity will not take five times as much concrete or five times as many workers as a plant that generates 200 megawatts of electricity. So the cost per kilowatt or megawatt of generation capacity for a larger plant is smaller. And conversely, when you go to smaller reactors, you lose out on those what are called economies of scale. And NuScale started its life with a 35 megawatt reactor design that went to 40, then to 45, then to 50. And then the 50 megawatt design was what was submitted to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission for design approval. And before the NRC could approve it, NuScale upped that number to 60 megawatts and then out to 77 megawatts. So you see that, you know, NuScale is kind of saying, you know, small really doesn't work. And if you leave them, give them another 20 years, they probably will end up at 770 megawatts. It's kind of reinforces the point that we've been saying. And the 77 megawatt design is still far from being licensed by the NRC. So construction is not about to start. And so the DOE cannot give them the $1.4 billion they have promised them.
And I think the other thing that you point out in the report, which is also very striking about NuScale, is that in 2008, they said, oh, we'll be operational by 2015 or 2016. And here we are in 2023, and all they've got is the design certification, which is effectively a piece of paper, and nothing else has happened. And that ought to be a sort of signal about where things are going. And you write in the report as well, there is no identifiable scenario under which they, i.e. SMRs, could become economical even under the best of circumstances. And all the numbers that you have there back this up. And yet there's sort of this obsessive, you know, continuing down the road, we're going to do SMRs anyway. I realize this is drifting into speculation, which you don't want to do, but I am curious to see whether in the research that you've done on SMRs, you've got another explanation for this determination to pursue this, even though all the numbers, all the economics point to it being a disaster, really.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's hard to know what's going on in the minds of these people. You know, they are smart people. They can get all the information that they want. But I think there is some level of wishful thinking that they have convinced themselves that nuclear is necessary. And they can see that large nuclear plants are just not working. I mean, just look at the example with Vogtle or with Flamanville in France. There is no real path for large reactors being built. And, you know, every large reactor that is being built is only more expensive than the other, the earlier ones, right? So if you look at Hinkley Point, that's become even more expensive than Flamanville and Olkiluoto. So clearly there are sort of negative learnings that's going on there. And so if you abandon the idea of large reactors, what are you left with? The only thing they can talk about is small reactors. And once the, you know, NuScale kinds of things implode, then they will start talking about advanced reactors, you know, molten salt reactors. They will find some other buzzword to fill that gap.
That was part one of our extended interview with Michael Schneider, M.V. Ramantha, and Michael Zeiler of the World Nuclear Industry Status Report. We'll have part two in the coming weeks. Now, if you wish to read this report, we will have a link to it up on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 616. My thanks to Linda Pence Gunter for her interviewing skills, as well as her invaluable support in putting this panel of experts together.
Activists, shout out, shout out, shout out.
Our friends at Gender and Radiation Impact Project let us know about some work by Dr. Lynn Carpenter. She's on the faculty of the University of Michigan and currently conducting a research project whereby she collects tree samples from radioactive trees around the world and genetically analyzes them using next-generation gene sequencing techniques. Ultimately, this work is to determine how many and what kind of mutations there are in radioactive leaves relative to leaves that were not exposed to radiation. This will be the first time anyone has used long-lived trees as living dosimeters, whereby they calibrate how much radiation was released in past areas where the radiation was not reported. This would include Chalk River and Three Mile Island, as well as areas around Fukushima. Finally, they will be looking for genetic markers and sequence patterns that indicate whether trees have been exposed to radiation or not. Dr. Carpenter adds, although people are obviously not trees, if we can conclude that trees have been exposed to a certain amount of radiation, we can infer that people in the region have been exposed as well. She is currently packing her bags and on her way to Fukushima. If you'd like to know more about her work, her website is treesoffukushima.com, and we will have a link to it up on our website. You can also reach out to her through the contact page at genderandradiation.org. And if you want to help Nuclear Hot Seat get seen, there's a real easy way to do it, and it helps you make sure that you never miss a single episode. Go to nuclearhotseat.com. There's a big yellow opt-in box there. Put in your first name, or make up a name, I don't care. But come up with an email address that you can access. And that way we will send you one email a week with the link to each week's show as soon as it posts, and a short description of some of the information involved. How does that help us get seen further? Because the database is read by the Google algorithm. And the more people we have on the database, the more weight Google gives to all of our posts. So go ahead, help us out. NuclearHotSeat.com, yellow box, and you'll never miss a single episode of Nuclear Hot Seat ever again. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, April 11, 2023. This show relies a lot on information coming from you, the listeners, who see nuclear whatever it is in your own backyard. So let us know. Don't be a stranger. You can send an email with a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, we really need your help. Anything. Truly, anything you can do, we'll be deeply grateful. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2023, Libby Halevi and Nuclear Hot Seat. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program with its website and the name of whoever you are citing. This is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat and Hardestry Communications, reminding you, the World Nuclear Industry Status Report is a barrier against utopian fantasies and wishful thinking, a tool to connect with reality. There you have it. You have just had your weekly nuclear wake-up call. Do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.